I've been sober too long to shake hands. Well, and I'm short, so yeah, there we go. Thanks.
There we go.
I'm not that short.
It'll work.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sherry Wells, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sherry.
My sobriety date is January 1st, 1987. Yes, that means I will be picking up 30 years in about a month. I can't wait. 2 months. No, 2 months. Okay. So, anyway, no, just kidding. My home group is the 12 Step Sisters meeting. We meet at the Quaker House on the corner of Piccadilly and Washington Street, 10 o'clock in the morning. It's a women's group, so if you're a woman, you can come. If you're a man and you want a drink, you can come too. So, I am currently serving as my group's opener and coffee maker. I also serve as a Blue Ridge Area Intergroup Trustee, and I am finishing my rotation as your Virginia Area Treasurer. So I say those things not to brag, but that is what's kept me sober for almost 30 years, is service, without a doubt. Man, I get so nervous. I really don't like standing up in front of people because I get really nervous. I could sit down and talk to you in a big circle for like 3 hours, but anyway, this makes me nervous. But I usually start with my parents, and I think it's pretty appropriate for me to talk about my parents, especially tonight. My mother was born at the base of Old Rag Mountain. When she was 4 years old, the government decided that they were going to make a park out of it. And she was moved out, and they gave them a little bitty house in the back of Madison. Instead of going across 29 this way, it's the next one up, and 5 acres and a little bitty house. She was the youngest of 11, and she had a resentment toward the government the rest of her life. But my dad was born in Montgomery, Alabama. He was the son of an alcoholic, a grandson of an alcoholic, and a great-grandson of an alcoholic. So here I am. I got the gene. My brother did not, but he married an alcoholic. So we can kind of see that this is a family illness. My parents, my dad left home when he was 13 because his father was a very chronic alcoholic, the kind that he was. And what I understand now, I didn't understand at the time, because my grandfather didn't drink the way I drank. I drank every day. I drank until I blacked out or passed out. My grandfather was a binge drinker, so he would not drink and come home and raise his kids and, you know, have a job and all that, and then he would drink and be gone for 6 months. So my dad left that home when he was 13, joined the Merchant Marines. When he was 15, he joined the Marine Corps, and he proceeded to stay in the Marine Corps 21 years. He was a gunnery sergeant. So if you ask me why I'm tough, that's why. My mom, like I said, was the youngest of 11. She moved in with her cousin in Washington, D.C. to take a job with the telephone company. And she met my dad on one of his weekend, I don't know what they call them, furloughs or whatever. You know, he came up to D.C. to have a good time. He was stationed in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. They met, got married, and they had my older brother. He's 3 years older than me. And then he was born in Memphis, Tennessee. I was born in Camp Lejeune. So for the next 10 years, we moved every 18 months. And that was hard. It was really hard. And I believe it was during this time that I learned how to not get attached to people. I learned that I would make good friends. You know, a few months later, we'd be in the car moving halfway across the country. So what I did by the time we got out of the service was not make friends anymore. Or I would make friends to a point, and I would never let anybody get close to me. I never saw my dad drink when I was a kid. Maybe one time. I remember we were stationed in Memphis, and it was the Marine Corps birthday. So he was in his dress blues. My mom was in a gown. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I heard this screaming. And my mother was not a screamer. But I heard my mom screaming, so I got out of bed and paddled down the hall. And my dad's throwing up. and my mom standing over top of him screaming at him. And I have the feeling that my dad drank that night, but I never, I mean, that's what I always did. I ended up puking, well, not so much, but anyway, my dad didn't like alcohol because he saw what it did to his family. My uncle Johnny became an alcoholic very early, just like I did, and he refused to drink. He wanted to be a successful man, so he refused to drink when I was a kid. He had a heart attack when I was in college, mild, very mild, and the doctor was going to put him on some blood thinner, and he refused, and the doctor said, well, if you have one drink a day, I won't put you on this medication. Well, we all know what one drink a day will do to an alcoholic, and by the time my dad passed away, he was drinking a liter of scotch a day. My mom and him, he was the disciplinarian. My mother was very quiet. She went to nursing school when we moved to Winchester because she wanted to do something with her life, and she'd never been able to do anything because we moved so often. We settled in Winchester because I was telling Jackie on the way down here, all my mom's family is seriously buried in that cemetery right up the road. But all but three of her brothers and sisters lived here in Madison. And one lived in Berryville, two lived in Front Royal, and Dad said, let's go to Winchester because I don't want to live in the same town with anybody, you know. So we settled in Winchester when I was 10. And I was in trouble already. I was that kid that didn't get any attention at home, so I knew how to get it in school. And I was bad. I was a bad, bad kid. I ended up being in the principal's office all the time. I caught my history teacher's waste basket on fire one day. I mean, it was, you know, I was just a bad kid. But what I realized was when I was bad, my dad would pay attention to me. Otherwise, the way I describe my family is we were four individuals living in a house together, but we didn't really resemble a family. We just kind of grew up. I mean, I just kind of grew up. I had good guidance. They were great people. They were really, really good people, both of my parents. But, you know, along the way, and I think it was because I was born an alcoholic, I really do. I already had those crazy tendencies. I already knew how to lie. I already knew how to cheat. I already knew how to steal. I knew all those things from very early. So I can remember when I was young, my aunt and uncle that lived in Berryville were alcoholics. And they always had a fifth of bourbon on the kitchen table. And they would put bourbon in their coffee. They would drink bourbon at lunch. They would drink bourbon all day. And I can remember crawling up on my Uncle Lloyd's lap and him giving me a taste of bourbon. And I can remember me wanting to crawl up on Uncle Lloyd's lap all the time when I was a kid. And I can remember being excited about going to Berryville. And I never really knew why. But it was because of the alcohol, I think. I don't know that for a fact. Because we would come to Virginia once a year. We'd come here in the summer to see Mom's family. We'd go to Florida where my other grandparents were in the winter, which is a nice touch. I'd come back burnt, you know, redhead out in the sun. I'd be burnt to a crisp. But so we moved to Winchester, got settled in. I was the bad kid in the class. And I had I got a best friend. Her name was Mita, and Mita's mom was a nurse. She worked second shift, and her dad worked at a factory in Winchester, and he worked third shift. So one Friday, Mita said, "Why don't you just ride the bus home with me? And you know, we'll just hang out because nobody's at my house." And her family was kind of like my family. Her dad was the alcoholic, but he drank. He came home in the morning and drank until he passed out. And then he would stay asleep until it was time for him to get up and go to work at midnight. But so I went home with Mita this day. I was 11. And we decided to crack open a bottle of a fifth of Canadian Mist. Well, we drank the whole bottle, fifth, 11 years old, two little girls. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I was somebody. I felt like this was what I was supposed to do with my life. that I was tall and pretty and I was great at everything I did, and I was just, it would just completely change my personality that day. And I woke up, my parents came to get me later that night, and I have no idea what happened. I don't know if they knew I was, I don't have no recollection. But the next morning I called Mita, and I was like, how you doing? What you doing? What you doing? And she's like, oh my God, I'm so sick. And I was like, oh my God, when are we going to do that again? I just couldn't wait to do it again. And so I chased that feeling for the next 17 years. I wanted, that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to have that same feeling that I got that day. But, you know, for a kid in elementary school, middle school, wasn't always easy to get alcohol. And I do qualify for our sister program, because I could always get something to make me feel like I wasn't Sherry. And that's really what I felt like. I felt like I needed to put something in my body so that I didn't feel who I really was. It was about this time that I realized that that there was something a little different about me. And that differentness was that I was gay. And this was something that I could not talk to my parents about. My mother was super, super religious. She made us, and it was a weird religion. We went to church on Saturdays. We didn't have Christmas. We didn't have Halloween. We didn't have Easter. You know, and that just added to my feeling different. You know, so I figured it all out in middle school. I just told everybody I was Jewish, and nobody ever asked me any questions about not having Christmas. I told you I was a great liar. So, but anyway, it was something that I couldn't talk to my mom about. By the time I got into high school, I was in real trouble with alcohol and other substances. Real trouble. I was addicted to amphetamines, and I drank every chance I got. Every chance. In Winchester back then, you could stop at most of the country stores and get a six-pack or two. And, you know, they didn't always card you. I mean, the drinking age back then was 18, and they didn't always card you, but by the time I got into high school, I was already in deep, deep trouble. I wrecked some cars. I never got a DUI, but I drove drunk every single day. Every single day I drove, and I was drunk. My dad always got me out of trouble. One time I wrecked a car. I hit a tree and left the scene of the accident. My dad, being the good dad that he was, got me out of bed at 5 o'clock. I walked home. I was like a mile from my house. Walked home. My whole face was bloody, but it was a little scratch. You know, I don't even know if I had a seatbelt on. I guess I didn't, because I tore off the rearview mirror. But, you know, he was a lot smarter than I was. He said, just go to bed. He said, just go to bed. We're not going to talk about it now. Just go to bed. But he woke me up at 5 o'clock in the morning to meet the tow truck to get it out of the ditch. And just as we got there, the state police got there. And my dad, he was a great liar, too. He said, she skidded on ice. And, of course, this was February, 5 o'clock in the morning. The ice would have still been there. And, you know, Dad was making all these excuses. So I finally looked at the police officer and I said, I fell asleep. And he said, and he threw the book at me, and, you know, reckless driving, leaving the scene of the accident, destruction of public property. I mean, just threw the book at me. And it was in Clark County. We were living in Clark County at that time. And we walked into court that day, and we walked through the doors, and the judge is setting up on that big pedestal. And he looks up and he sees my dad, and he's like, Ray, how you doing? I'm like, what? And the DA, the guy that is going to prosecute me, turns around, and he's like, he gets up and shakes my dad's hand, and I'm like, oh, yeah, this is going to be good. So anyway, my dad just strolls right through those little doors and walks up and shakes the judge's hands, and they whisper back and forth a couple times, and he comes back and sits down with me, and Dad stopped and talked to the guy, the lawyer, and comes back and sits down. He says, first thing he's going to say, you say not guilty. Second thing he's going to say, you say guilty. And I was like, well, what is he going to... He said, just do those two things. So What he did was he read off all the charges. I said, not guilty. He read off the next charge. The lawyer stood up and said, we will take improper driving. We will accept an improper driving plea. And the judge said, Miss Wells, how do you plead? And I said, guilty. So, you know, I would have had my license taken away and might have probably gone to jail. But that was really the story of my life. I would get in trouble, and my dad would get me out of trouble. So when I graduated from high school, I went to college, and wow, how much fun was that? I never went to class. I went to Mary Washington my first semester. I was smart, and I was a good test taker, so my SAT scores got me into Mary Washington. I'll just put it like that. And but they were different. They didn't drink. They didn't party. They went to class all the time. And it was hard. I mean, when I was in high school, I never had to crack a book. I'd just take the test, straight A's, you know, going with my life. But I had to study at Mary Washington. And of course, you know what that meant. I got out of there quick. So I transferred to Shepherd College in West Virginia, which was a huge party in school, and I fit right in there. You know, I could wear my sweatpants, and I could be, you know, little gay Sherry, and nobody ever thought weird of me. And so for the next year and a half, I did that. I didn't go to college, but I was living there on campus. So at the end of that 2 years, they asked me not to come back. I mean, I had like a 1.3 GPA, and my dad's like, well, do you want to go to college, or what are you doing? And I was like, well, I don't really want to go to college. I don't know what I want to do. So they decided they weren't going to pay for it anymore. So I thought, well, I'll just quit. Shortly after that, I got a job working at this place called Capitol Records in Winchester on third shift. And the summer that I graduated from high school, I met a young lady, and I came home from college almost every weekend to see her. So by the time I quit college, we'd been together for 2 years. And about a year after I quit college, my dad's part of the family always has sinus problems. So I'd always keep all this sinus medicine, and he never knew why I kept the sinus medicine in my room, but I kept it in my bedroom, and he went into the drawer because he had, you know, some sinus problems, and he found there was a yellow piece of legal paper, and because I'd forgotten to hide it, and it was a letter from, her name was Peanut, it was a letter from her talking, you know, and it was spelled out. So I got off work one Friday morning. My mother was not home, which was unusual. My dad was home, which was unusual, because my dad worked 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I walked through the door, and he said, he handed me the letter, and he said, are you a homosexual? And I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. I just sat there and I was like, and he said, well, obviously you are. And he said, you got to get out. And I was like, what? And he said, you can't be in this house. Your mother doesn't want you in this house. So I left. And I drank. I drank more. I got a little apartment in Winchester. A little while later, I got a job working for General Electric. Miracle. Best job in the world. I mean, one of the things that I was born with, other than, you know, my dad gave me all the good stuff. He gave me the alcoholism, but he also gave me mechanical aptitude. I could fix anything. Anything ever broke around the house, my mom would ask me to fix it. Not my dad, because my dad was never home. Whether it be an alarm clock or the lawnmower or the washing machine, whatever it was, I could just figure out what was wrong with it. So I was the first woman mechanic to ever make the inside of the light bulb in North America, and I was in that job for over 20 years. I worked for General Electric for 31. But same thing. I had a foreman that took care of me. I worked second shift. I'd go into work blasted every day, and he'd take one look at me and say, don't touch the equipment for 2 hours. So, you know, I was surrounded by people that enabled me to keep drinking. And I was living the dream. I could stay up all night long drinking, go to bed when the sun came up, sleep a few hours, get up and go to work at 3, get off at 11. I mean, it was a great life. I had a brand new car. I paid cash for. They paid me way more money than I was worth. I bought a house, and I was dead inside. Absolutely dead. Spiritually, emotionally. During this time, we went to a 12-hour shift, and it enabled me to have, 1 week I would have Tuesday and Thursday off. The next week I would have Monday, Tuesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday off, and it shot my liver. Because I would start drinking on a Thursday night, and I would not stop until 5 o'clock on Monday morning when I had to go back to work. So I had a tolerance break with my liver. It quit working. So I could drink, and I could drink 2 beers, and I would be, like, unable to walk. Or I could drink a case of beer and not feel anything. I didn't know that's what it was. I didn't know that was my liver giving out. Until a few years later. But my alcoholism just kept getting worse. I tried to stop. I did stop for 10 days one time. And everybody around me was saying, man, you need to drink. You know, because I was crazy. And on December 31st, 1986, I'd gone to a party. I had preceded that party by drinking a case of beer. That was my normal. My normal was drinking a case of beer and a fifth of whatever, something. That was a day-to-day, except the days I was working. I couldn't drink that much in a short amount of time. So I drank a case of beer and gone to another party in the afternoon and drank I don't know how much. And I took a fifth of Jack Daniels with me to this New Year's Eve party, and I drank all that, except for one sip. There was this much left in that bottle. So I got home that night, passed out in the car. Peanut left me in the car. She came back out to try to get me up, and I threw up, which was unusual for me. I mean, I don't know why, but I wasn't a thrower-upper. But I threw up that night, and she finally got me in the house, got me into bed. I threw up. She got me up, put me in the bathroom, washed me off, changed the sheets, put me back to bed. I did it again. So she just took me and put me on the bathroom floor, no clothes. And something happened to me that night. It was the middle of the night. I don't know when it was, but I had a spiritual experience. And what happened was I was standing in the bathroom door, looking at me, laying on the floor. And I'd thrown up all over myself. I had peed myself, and I defecated. And I didn't know who that was laying in that floor. I couldn't figure that out. Who is that? I mean, I was supposed to be somebody. You know, what happened to me? And for the first time in my life, although people had been telling me for about 10 years that I had a problem with alcohol, for the first time in my life, I realized that my problems were coming from alcohol. So the next 3 days, I stayed on my bathroom floor. Couldn't keep anything down. I went through DTs. I had no idea that I could have died. But I knew that if I left that bathroom that I was going to go drink. So I stayed there. And you know, if you've been sober for a while and you look back across your, you know, what got you here, it's really a miracle, isn't it? It's just a miracle. Well, that the night before, GE always shut down for 2 weeks at Christmas. And the night before we shut down, my sister-in-law, Peanut's sister, had gotten a fifth of Wild Turkey for Christmas. Well, you know, she's a good alcoholic too. We drank together. And she unleashed that wild turkey and passed out on the picnic table by the employee entrance. So they said, they suggested that she go to treatment. And back then it was called Chit Chat. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Chit Chat. Is a Karen Foundation treatment center. It's now in the, Edge Hill is now in the same building that Chit Chat was in. But so of course they said, you know, you can, we can fire you or you can go to treatment. Of course she figured that treatment would be a vacation, so she went to treatment. And on that fourth day, Peanut came in and she said, I'm going to Chit Chat to see Teresa, and we're doing a family thing. You have to go, in order to see her, you have to go through this family thing, and I think you should get up and go. So I did. I don't know why, where, or how that I got the ability, but I took a shower and I went, and they put all the family members in one room and they played Father Martin's Chalk Talk. I don't know if any of y'all have ever heard, seen that. But he described my life, my whole life. You know, that inability to connect with people, that feeling of complete isolation and loneliness and separation and feeling always different than and never a part of. He described all my feelings. And he said that the alcoholic is not a sick person, is not a bad person. They're a sick person. And man, I was blown away. So I started crying. And we weren't, we were not allowed to cry when I was a kid. My dad was a gunny sergeant, like I said, so there was no crying in our household. And I started to cry. So at the end of that movie, all these people, you know, there's probably this many people sitting in this room and they're all looking at me like, what the heck's wrong with her? You know, why is she crying? I'm thinking, I don't belong in the Al-Anon room. I belong in the other room. So anyway, my sister-in-law came in and got me. She got me out of the room, and she took me to this therapist. And this therapist took one look at me, and she said, so what'd you think of that movie? And I was like, it talked about my whole life. And she didn't tell me to go home and pack a bag and check myself into treatment, because I wouldn't have done it. But she did say, why don't you meet us at some AA meetings? I was like, what the heck is AA? And she said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, okay. So the first meeting, this was on a Saturday. And I stayed sober until Wednesday. I met them at the Wednesday meeting. And it was a step 1, 2, 3 meeting. And, of course, it was on the third step that night. So they mentioned the word God. And I was out. Ears clicked off. I was too embarrassed to get up and walk out. But I just sat in there. But my ears clicked off because I had had enough of God. I'd been shoved down my throat my whole life. And I wasn't about to hear any more about it. And I just figured that this was a religious program. And they wanted to make me into something that my mother had been trying to make me into my whole life. And at the end of the meeting, when the discussion part's over and it goes back to the chairman to do the closing, he said the most important thing that I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, probably because it was meant for me that night. He said, if you do not believe in God, don't let that keep you out of the rooms of AA. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have to believe in anything. You just don't pick up a drink a day at a time and come to meetings. And so that's what I did. When I was 3 months sober, and I was angry. Oh my gosh, I was so angry. I had a pallet full of disappointment in my life, resentment. I was full of resentments. And I would go, my home group, I didn't know I joined this home group, but they told me I had to stay for this home group meeting one night. And I couldn't understand why these women kept, I told Jackie, Jackie is my grand sponsee. She's been sober for a few months now. Congratulations. So I was telling her on my way down here, you know, I would sit in this women's meeting on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock and beat my fist on the table. I was so mad. And they'd say, keep coming back. We'd be like, what the heck's wrong with these women? You know, gosh, you know, and it's exactly, I was trying to push them away. You know, I'd never had anybody come close. I had all these, you know, wall after wall after wall built up for my protection. And these women put up with me. It was amazing. So at 3 months sober, they said, hey, you need to stay for this meeting after the meeting. And I'm like, well, what is it? Well, it's called a home group meeting. I'm like, I'm not doing that. And he said, well, you know, it's, you know, just stay. So I stayed, and I refused to get a sponsor because, you know, I was, excuse my language, I was a badass, and I didn't need a sponsor. I didn't need anybody telling me what to do or what to say. And so I stayed for this meeting, and they said, what do you do on Friday nights? And I was like, well, I go to the meeting at Christ Episcopal. Well, there's a meeting at 7 o'clock at the Quaker House. It's called Intergroup, and you need to go. It's the third Friday of every month. That's all you have to do is just show up, take notes, and come back next month and tell us what they talked about. I was like, well, I don't even know what it is. They said, it doesn't matter. Just go. Well, that was my first service commitment. I didn't know that. These people, I'm telling you. But before that, this big meeting, we had the biggest meeting in Winchester, was on Friday night in Christ Episcopal Church's basement. And we all smoked. I didn't smoke. I quit smoking before I quit drinking because I thought that that's what was keeping me awake at night, because I would get up every hour and a half and smoke. But what it was, I was getting up every hour and a half to drink, and I would smoke while I was drinking. So I thought, oh, it's the cigarettes that are keeping me from sleeping all night. So anyway, they all smoked, and there was 100 people in this little basement with these little windows like this. By 8:15, by 9:15, you couldn't see across the room because of the haze. But when that meeting was over, this man, his name was Big Ed, he said, you need to help me in the kitchen. I was like, do what? And he's like, you need to help me wash ashtrays. Well, I won't say out loud what I said to him that night, but he said, no, you're going to help me tonight. He said, what are you thinking about doing tonight? I said, well, I'm thinking about stopping and getting some beer. He said, help me do these ashtrays. So after a half an hour of washing ashtrays and him sitting on his big behind beside me on a stool, you know, I'm like, hey, you didn't even do any work. He said, he's been sober like 25 years at this time. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was like, well, how you feeling now? I said, man, I'm tired. I had to work today, and I'm tired. He said, well, so what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to go home and go to bed. He said, all right, see you next week. So next week, I go in there. I said, Sherry, it's time to do the ashtrays. I had no idea what these people were doing to me. They were introducing me to service before I even knew what service was. So every Friday night, I did ashtrays, and Ed sat on that stool and talked to me about how he stayed sober every Friday night. Because on Friday nights, you know, that was the beginning of the weekend, and I like to drink on the weekends. Of course, I used to say that. I drink every day. But so I had, but within the first year, I had two big service positions. I finally had a lady volunteer to be my sponsor because I wouldn't ask her and wouldn't follow any directions. I'd go to just a few meetings a week and be mean and nasty. And then Thanksgiving came around, and I went home for Thanksgiving. And I thought, oh, man, this is going to be great. It's Thanksgiving, and I'm not drinking, and it's going to be great. Well, I walked in the door, and by this time, my dad's, you know, sprung. He's off and drinking. And what I realized was nothing has changed in my family. My dad was drunk. My sister-in-law was drunk. My brother was mad at my sister-in-law and my dad. My mother was busy running around trying to make everybody unmad. And I was a crazy lunatic with 11 months sobriety. And the compulsion came back that night for me. Screw this. I don't need this. If this is the way it's going to be, I'm just going to drink. So I got in my car to go home that night. And there was a little country store. My parents were living out right over the Route 50 bridge, the Shenandoah River Bridge. And there was this little country store, and okay, I'm going to stop there. Well, the doggone thing was closed. So, well, Waterloo's right up here, so drive up to Waterloo. Back then, the only thing in Waterloo was a truck stop. They sold beer there, though. Well, the truck stop was closed. I was like, what the heck's going on? You know, back then, that's when the country was great. We closed for Thanksgiving Day. Nobody had to work on Thanksgiving. And all the stores were closed, except for 7-Eleven. So I was like, all right, well, Winchester's not that far, and there's a 7-Eleven right where my subdivision is. And I'm driving, and I'm thinking, why are you going to drink? And then I remember what y'all said. There will come a time when nothing stands between you and a drink except for God. And I prayed. And I said, God, please just get me home. Please just get me home. And I got home and I walked in the door and I picked up the phone and I called that sponsor. And she said, get back in your car, do not stop, and drive to my house. So I pulled up to her house and 40 people walk out at me. I'm like, what the? What is all this? But all her family and a bunch of AA people were there for Thanksgiving. And right after that, I realized that, you know, I was in trouble. I was in trouble. My sobriety was in trouble. But I did start to pray after that. I started to ask God every morning. And although I didn't believe in God, she said, well, use my God. She said, you know, ask my God in the morning to keep you sober and at night thank him for keeping you sober. So that's exactly what I'd pray. Pamela's God, can you keep me sober today? Pamela's God, thank you. Thank you for keeping me sober. And that's the way it worked for me. It worked. But so in January of 1988, I went out to a bar because I was still a bar goer. I still kept going to bars. And I went to the bar, ordered a Diet Coke. They handed me a drink. I took a drink, and it was rum and Coke. I put it down. I walked over and I got peanut and I said, we got to go. The next day I called my sponsor and I told her what happened and she told me to meet her at Chit Chat. And I met her and she checked me in. She checked me into treatment. I'm like, well, I don't need to go to treatment. She said, you're angry. You're full of resentment. You need something more than what AA can give you right now. So I did that. I went. I checked myself in 13 months sober to treatment. And it was the absolute best thing I could ever do for my sobriety. I beat that bag 5 times. They believed in anger sessions, and I just beat and beat and beat. I worked on the stuff that just gnawed at me, the stuff that was down, you know, down to my toenails, all that rage and anger. And it completely changed the way I looked at sobriety. I started going to more meetings. I got involved. I started sponsoring people when I was 2 years sober. I jumped into the program after I got out of treatment. I just started doing steps. I started doing more service. In 1990, Winchester District was dead, black, or dark, what we call it, dark. And we started the Winchester District again in 1990. I got involved in that. I think I was the secretary or something. I did every committee at the district. I did every committee at the intergroup. I just did whatever people asked me to do. I learned that for me to stay busy was a good thing. So a year at a time, I would take a job. And on my four year anniversary, I've had 2 bad years in 30. 2 bad years. On my 4 year anniversary, one of my dogs got sick and she went down. She was a dachshund. She went down and her spinal cord severed from too much weight. And we kept her alive for 7 days and then we let her go. And I cried. I cried for 6 weeks, 6 solid weeks. A few months after that, we found out my other dog, she wouldn't eat. And when she did eat, she threw up. And we realized, we took her to a specialist down in Manassas, and we found out that she had a congenital heart defect, and her something about a vein crossed over her esophagus, and her esophagus was this big around, but yet there was a hole this big at the bottom. So we spent a lot of money to try to fix her, and it didn't work. It was a lot to deal with. Grief was something that I wasn't used to dealing with because I just drank. But about this time, I'd gone through the steps and I'd made my amends except to my dad, because for some reason I always thought it was my dad. My anger came out at my dad, but I kept praying for the gift of forgiveness. And one morning I woke up and I'd forgiven him. I went directly to his house. I called my sponsor. She told me what to do. I went, and my dad never talked to me about AA. It'd been sober 4 years, and he never mentioned AA. You know, no alcoholic wants to talk about AA. And I walked in the house, and I walked down the stairs, and he said, "Hey, I met this guy that knows you." And I was like, "Well, who is it?" And he said, "His name is Bob Grumheller," or something like that. "He goes to those AA meetings with you." I was like, see, I'd gone to make amends to my dad. That's why I was at his house. And for me, the spiritualness comes out in the physical by a little tap on the shoulder. I've got lots of taps on this side, which is my lower power. But I also get taps on this side, which is God telling me that I'm doing the right thing. So I proceeded to tell my dad, you know, what the ninth step meant. And that I needed to make amends to him. And he said, he stopped me and he said, "No." He said, "You know, you... everything I ever did, I did because I loved you, and you never knew that. You never knew that I loved you because I've never told you that I loved you." I was 34 years old, and it was the very first time my dad had ever told me he loved me. He said, "I was never ashamed of you for who you are. I've always been proud of who you turned out to be. Even you being gay never made me ashamed of you, and it almost killed me when your mother made you leave the house." Now, my mother and I, we got back together after a couple years because of my sister-in-law and my brother. It was one of those subjects that we just didn't talk about. But we agreed to disagree about my life and how I lived it so that she could be my mom and I could be her daughter. So that was Labor Day weekend. That was September. And we had like a 2-hour conversation about my life, his life. He told me stuff that I never knew about his dad and how he actually grew up and why he left at 13. And it was just amazing. It was an amazing day. And I left there to go to an AA picnic. And 2 weeks later, my mom called me and said that my dad wasn't feeling well. He had had one lung removed 4 years earlier from lung cancer. And said they were, you know, being a Marine, he wanted to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital, so I drove him, and they did a bronchoscope on him, and then they showed us the film, and you know, the Navy doctor said, "Gunny, go home and get your stuff in order." Dad's like, "Okay, let's go." I was like, I didn't even know what was happening, you know, I really didn't know what was happening, and I said, what are you talking about?" And my mom's going on and on and on about radiation and chemotherapy and this and that and the other. And I'm like, "What's going on?" And Dad said, "The cancer's back." And that was the beginning of October. You know, God's grace allowed me to make amends before all that happened, because it would have been different if I would have tried to make amends to him after we knew he was dying. So for the next, he lived 4 months. The next 4 months I was at his house every day. We had conversations that were crazy, funny and crazy. And I mean, when I die, I hope I die like he died. I mean, he died with dignity, never feeling sorry for himself. And I was there. I was there for him. And so my dad passed away. And about that time, I realized that, you know, Peanut and I had been together for 10 years when I got sober. So 4 years later, I was not real happy in the relationship. She was, you know, a child of an alcoholic that was not in touch with her emotions, and I didn't feel like she was giving me what I deserved or whatever. I was the, you know, that chronic self-will run riot. So I had an affair. I did something that made me closer to a drink than any point in my recovery. Before then and since then, I had an affair. And I decided to leave that relationship. We'd been together for 20 years by this time. By the time I had the affair, we had just celebrated our 20-year anniversary. And I was in trouble again with my sobriety, big trouble. I called my best friend who'd been sober about 5 years less than me. She came and got me out of the house and, you know, walked me through it. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous walked me through it. We broke up. Me and this young lady got together. And, you know, what I did then was I bailed on AA. I bailed out. I was so enmeshed with her and her life that I put myself in a really unhealthy situation. She was 15 years younger than me. She was young. She liked to drink. I mean, just completely against what I stood for in my life. I was surrounded by alcohol again all the time. But I bailed. But we stayed together for 14 years. We had a little girl, beautiful, red-haired, blue-eyed little baby. And I didn't have her. She did. God's got a great sense of humor. She looks so much like me, but she's got her mom's curly hair. But my mom did remarry after my dad died. And she married a deacon in her church, and he did not like me because I was gay. So that vicious cycle started all over again. They bought a house down in Florida, and they spent most of their time down there. But they had come home a few weeks in the summer, and I realized that there was not something a little bit wrong with my mom. She couldn't remember things, and you know, she was just a little off. And every summer she got a little bit worse. And so after a few years, I realized that my mom had early onset Alzheimer's. So my next bad year, that first bad year, I lost both of my dogs and my dad within 13 months. And I did not pick up a drink. I just cried. The next bad year was General Electric made the announcement that they were going to move, close the plant and move it to Mexico. And because I had 31 years, I was okay because I got to retire with full benefits. I was 51 years old. The next thing that happened was my stepfather dropped dead from a massive heart attack, and my mother came back to live with in her house. She kept her house in Stephen City. And my brother moved in with her because he was not there when my dad died. He couldn't be there. He couldn't do it. He couldn't be a part of it. He was emotionally incapable of being there for my dad and my mom during that time. And he felt bad about it. 2 years after my dad died, my brother told me he wanted to kill himself, and I checked him into a hospital. And it was all because of shame and grief and, you know, that guilt of not being there for my dad. And I helped him through that time because I was sober. So he moved in with my mom, and we took care of her for a year. But that was in February. My stepfather died on my birthday on February 17th. We were just talking about February 16th. But he died on my birthday on February 17th. Mom came back. Steve moved in with her. And then I would always go. I would always have her on Wednesdays and Sundays. And I came home on a Sunday afternoon, beautiful day. She was good. She recognized some of her brothers and sisters and said them by name. It was one of those days. It was gorgeous, not real hot, August day. And I walked in, and my partner at the time was crying. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I'm not in love with you anymore." So I asked her to go to therapy. I asked her to try to work it out. And we did, and it did not work out. So after a few months, I bought a house not too far from her, about 5 miles from her, and we got a schedule. I get my daughter Grace, her name is Grace, on Monday, Wednesday, and every other weekend, and she gets her on Tuesday, Thursday, every other weekend, and my daughter's... she's good with that. That was the schedule that she picked out because she didn't want to not see in one of us like for a week. We were like, "Well, don't you want to do a week at a time?" She's like, "No, because I'll miss you guys." So my daughter's now 14, gorgeous, smart, and a good child. Completely different than me. So anyway, it was a bad year. You know, the job, my mom was bad by this time. She was bad. Got her into a nursing home after a year. But she always knew who I was. But she turned into somebody different. My mom did. She turned into somebody that loved me. She turned into somebody that held my hand when I went to see her and told me how beautiful I was. She turned into the mother that I always wanted. My mom had a heart attack 2 years ago, and it took out 3/4 of her heart. And I went to the emergency room, And the doctor said she'll be dead within a couple hours. This was a Friday morning. I called my brother and he said, I can't come. I can't do it. So I stayed with my mom. And she didn't die. She just kept right on. So finally they took us upstairs and put us in a room, and Saturday went by, and Saturday morning after my home group, like 30 women showed up. I was like, well, I can't leave the room. I was afraid to leave her room. And they showed up, and my best friend Julie, the one that did, you know, came and got me that day after I told her I was having an affair, I was in trouble. She came and got me. She said, I'm going to sit in here while you go downstairs. So I went down there for about 5 minutes, and I thanked everybody for coming, and then I went back upstairs. Sunday went by. She was still alive. So, I during this weekend, I gave her a pedicure, which, if any of you have dealt with old people, is really nasty. I gave her a manicure. I plucked her chin hairs. I put lotion on her, and I just loved her. I crawled in bed with her, and I held her, and I talked to her. Finally, on Monday afternoon, I called my brother, and I said, you got to tell her goodbye. So I held the phone up to her ear, and he told her, and he talked to her for a long time. And about an hour later, the doctor came in, and it was a woman, and I said, well, you know, because I can remember Dad, his legs looked different the day he died. His legs were gray and weird color looking. And so the doctor walks in, and I said, her legs are different today. They're a different color. And she said, Sherry, it's happening now. And I said, what? And she said, look at her. And her breathing had changed. So I said, get out. So they got out of the room, turned the light off, and I got in bed with my mom. And I held her. And I told her I loved her, and I thanked her for what she'd done for me. And I told her I forgave her for what she did to me. And that regardless of all that struggle that we had my whole life, I loved her today, and it was okay for her to go. And she took her last breath in my arms, and it was the greatest gift that I've ever been given, besides the birth of my daughter and getting sober. You know, in 30 years, I've had two bad years. Right after Joe and I broke up, Grace's mom, Chris Wells, I don't know if y'all know Chris Wells, she called me. She was the chairman of the Virginia area, and she said, I want you to come back and be a committee chair. Because I'd been the DCM. I'd actually served as Archives Committee Chair on the Virginia area level in 1995-96. But I bailed out. I still went to meetings, but I didn't go to very many meetings. No wonder she left me. But anyway, because let's face it, without meetings, we are not sober people. Without enough meetings. So Chris asked me to come back, and she said, I want you to be the website committee chair. And I said, I don't know anything about websites. She said, doesn't matter. You know how to run a committee. So I said, all right. That was 6 years ago. The next rotation, I said yes to being the Finance and Budget Committee Chair. 2 years ago, I said yes to, well, I didn't say yes. They elected me as Treasurer of the Virginia Area Committee. And I thought, what the heck are y'all thinking? You know, it's not thousands, it was thousands of dollars, but it's the best job. Every job I've had in AA is the best job I've had in AA. You know, they keep getting better and better. But so a few weeks ago, we went to the Fall Assembly in Virginia Beach, and I got a call the Wednesday night before that the alternate chair was not going to stand for the position as chair. And I was told, voluntold, that I was going to stand for that job. And I was like, no, I want to be alternate chair. That's because, you know, I'm used to doing the next right thing. And I had no idea that they would do that. I had no idea that they were going to elect me, but I'm now your chair-elect for the Virginia Area Committee. And very excited, very, very excited. The phone calls that I've been able to make to ask people to serve as a committee chair, it's like the best. I mean, these people are so excited. I forgot what it was like. You know, because when Chris called me, I was under the gun. I mean, I was really bad. I was in bad shape, lot of grief, a lot of just stuff. But I needed to be dragged back into AA. And then when Elliot asked me to be the finance and budget chair, I remember how excited I was. And when I made these 18 phone calls for committee chairs and special assigns, I remember what it was like. That excitement, that, oh my gosh, yay, I get to serve. I get to stick around here. You know, for me, service has always been there. I don't say yes to everything today. I did say yes to driving to Madison County. Thanks, Billy. I only sponsor a certain amount of women. I only sponsor 5 women. At 2 years, I was sponsoring 12. And I was not of service to those 12 women. I was not. I was incapable of sponsoring that many people. And today, my ego is a little bit less, just a little bit. So 5 is good for me. I'm surrounded by sponsees, grand sponsees, great grand sponsees. I think I even have a great grand sponsee now. I'm feeling kind of old talking about that. But, you know, if you're new, get involved in something. Whether it's making coffee, we don't do ashtrays anymore, but cleaning up the coffee. My best conversation since I've been sober is getting to a meeting, and I still get to my home group. Even if I'm not opening, I still get there at 9:30 because those are the best conversations. And sticking around a half hour after the meeting's over, you know, when somebody new walks in the door that you've never seen before, get up, go welcome them, make them feel a part of, because that's what we need. That's what I needed. I needed to finally feel a part of something. I never felt a part of anything in my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new or you're struggling, or if you have 20 or 30 years and you're struggling, you know, get involved in service. Jump back in the middle of the boat, because in the middle of the boat, we're safe. When we're sitting on the edge of that boat, you know, a wave can come by and hit you real hard and knock you right out of that boat. And that has almost happened to me a few times since I've been sober. But as long as I'm safe and secure in the middle of that thing, everything's good. Thank you all for having me, and thank you, Billy.